Please turn to page 4 of that session 1 handout. Which is the page that has to do with academic conversations that can inform the kind of work that we're doing. And for just about 3 minutes, I'd like to pause over number 6 and tell you about a wonderful colleague of mine at Calvin College, David Smith. David has written one of the books that's recommended in the bookstore having to do with teaching practices. And he's given a lot of thought to the way we engage in teaching and learning. He actually spends his life advising and working with Christian educators, from people who educate young children through college around the world, through a center called the Kier Center for Teaching and Learning. One of the things I've learned from David is that underneath not only the content, but also the pedagogy of most courses, there is an implicit metaphor. And these metaphors are often unarticulated, but in fact are very powerful. A lot of courses that I remember teaching or taking when I was a college student, I look back now, and I am clearly aware that the professor was operating with a map metaphor. The professor was aware that there was this whole field out there that had to be mapped. And a lot of our coverage of material, a lot of our discussion of material, was so that we could learn the map. So we would fly through material, right? I know that at IWS this sometimes happens too, right? I arrived here and my good friend Lester Roos said, I get to do 500 years this morning. Right? There is value in a map. A map gives us a picture of the whole, and it tells us about the relationships of one thing to another. But a map, as a metaphor for teaching, is very different than the metaphor of pilgrimage. A pilgrimage is really a riff on another basic metaphor, the metaphor of journey. If we were doing a map of liturgical history, we would easily do 500 years in a morning. You're simply wanting to see the relationship of the big parts to each other. But if we were doing the history of worship using the pilgrimage metaphor, we would instead go to very specific places in the history of worship. And I'll just talk about my dear friend Lester for a few minutes. He's very good at doing this, right? Some of you have had him. So you'll spend time really encountering and savoring Egeria in 4th century Jerusalem, or Luther in the 16th century, or Wesley. When you take the pilgrimage route through church history, you skip most of the material. Just like when I take a trip from here to Miami, I only see about 3% of the territory that there is to see, right? I'm taking just one route through the territory. Do you get the sense in which these implicit metaphors can work? One of the metaphors that David talks a lot about is how in many fields, the metaphor we work with is the metaphor of a building. There is a course, you might recognize too, that has the title Foundations. Right? And so a course or a session lays the foundation, and then we build on that knowledge, additional knowledge, as if we are constructing a building. Educators will quite often, in fact, even use that metaphor to generate other language. Like elementary school teachers say, we're trying to create scaffolding, right, by which young learners will repeat material, and eventually the scaffolding, the technique by which they multiply two numbers, will fall away and they will be left with the knowledge. In some sciences, a lot of learning is the kind of learning that is built on the foundation and then moves up. It's logical and sequential. Another metaphor might be the metaphor of a garden. You might say, that's a very unusual thing. But in fact, it's built right into the, one of the most common educational terms we use for young children, kindergarten. And it has behind it a very thoughtful Christian teacher following the Reformation by the name of Comenius. Comenius thought that the best kind of Christian education should not be conceived as a building that we construct, but as a garden we inhabit. And so actually, David Smith, when he works with some of us on teaching and learning, will say, picture your classroom as a garden. And I'm just curious, I just mentioned this crazy metaphor. What does that metaphor carry with it? What are the connotations and denotations that are behind?
Delight.
Delight. Huge part of it. Yes, David would be thrilled you said that. That's exactly right. It's delight.
Nurturing and growth.
Absolutely.
Organic.
Different growth rates. The need for a gardener. Okay, there's a tending that happens.
Variety.
Yes. Now, of course, someone could point out that, yes, there are English gardens and there are French gardens and there are Japanese gardens, and all these gardens are a little bit different. But they all do share some certain properties. And one thing that we also think about a garden is usually not, except maybe in some like French royal gardens, it is not built around the concept of sequence. Right. So if you're building a building, you had better try to lay the foundation before you put on the roof. Right? There is a careful sequence that you have to go through in teaching and learning. But if you enter a garden, right, you can actually spend time learning about that tree and then learning about that vegetable. Right? You're moving around. Right? It hadn't occurred to me to just now that this is, in fact, an elaborate defense of the pedagogy of these 2 days, jumping from hither and yon, actually. But it just occurs to me that there's a little bit of it, right? But think about how powerful just the word kindergarten is. Because if you were to describe the difference between kindergarten and first grade, in most schools, it is, in fact, the difference between less concern about sequence and more concern about sequence. The minute you start numbering first, second, third, fourth, you have just entered a different metaphoric world underlying the pedagogy. It's surprisingly powerful. Right. Just to be, complete here on this list, we should put in a good word for Augustine. He's always a good person to refer to in a class like this. Augustine and the medieval, later Benedictine Dominican traditions, where illumination was the key metaphor for learning. You get this a little bit when we, in English, talk about having a light bulb moment, right? Where all of a sudden we're talking about material and the light bulb goes on, right? This moment of discovery or illumination. And of course, illumination is a major scriptural theme, right? Psalm 36, is it? In your light, we see light. Open our eyes that we may see Jesus, this moment of perception and sight. And then the other interesting metaphor that is being talked a lot about among educational theorists as also deep Christian resonances, it's the metaphor of nourishment. Right? Take and eat this scroll. Right? What did our class at IWS allow us to digest? And what's sort of the point of that metaphor? Anything that occurs to you about that metaphor, what its value or what it's trying to get at?
Take it in.
It doesn't remain externalized, right? A map is still talking about externalized material, right? I could walk into a chemistry class, receive a map, right, of the table of elements, know about this body of knowledge. But unless I'm a real chemistry major, I walk out a little bit unchanged. Right? It remains something I can leave in the classroom. Right? Now, a real chemistry major would never let me get away with that. Right? They say a little different. Right? But if I teach and learn in order to ingest, right, there's a connection with identity. Right? What we take in becomes a part of us. So I bring this up simply to say, I wonder what metaphor I don't think there's one. Which metaphors could most help us think about the kind of teaching that is needed with respect to worship? And I do not come to you today with an answer. I come with a question. What do you think of these metaphors would be the most productive or generative meta-metaphor? Meta-metaphor. How do you like that? Meta-metaphor. That can guide our approach to teaching, even in the informal moments in the worship life of the church. Just right off the top of your head, what do you think of the ones we've talked about?
The garden idea.
The garden idea. Let me actually push this gardening metaphor just a little bit. There are a few philosophies of gardening, I mentioned French royalty, in which the gardener comes in with a bulldozer, totally flattens everything, and then puts a predetermined stamp on that garden, right? Regardless of the territory. But this is a very rare approach to gardening. Most gardening, you go with what you have. You work with what is given, right? What a given climate will support, and the local scenery. And then you, as the gardener, adapt to it, and you work with that material, right? And then bring others in to appreciate not just the plants you have planted, but the way they relate to their environment. There's something about the honoring the local that's built into it. Yeah, great. Go ahead.
Food, dinner, meals, that's a helpful metaphor, I think.
Great. And we're talking with a couple of you yesterday about the image of music that we sing. Right? Spiritually speaking, we are what we sing. As musicians, we are like spiritual dietitians. We need the combination of proteins, carbohydrates, and the like that will feed a healthy spiritual diet. Right? That's just working. It's totally playing with that metaphor. Right? It'll show up in a few minutes too.
Right, go ahead. About 30 years ago, the metaphors were farming and ranching.
Okay. Farming and ranching. Can you say just a bit about how that played out?
Well, a lot of it was organizing the church. So as a pastor, I don't have time to farm. I'm a rancher. As the congregation gets larger. And so it kind of depended on the size of the congregation.
Okay. I encourage us, this is just a few minutes at the front end of the day, but to be aware as this day unfolds about these kind of implicit metaphors. The one metaphor that I get a little nervous about with respect to worship, well, maybe actually there's two we should name some cautions about. I think mapping is a really good thing at the Institute of Worship Studies. Right? In fact, the curriculum already maps the territory, right? There are courses in sacraments, history, Bible, theology. But I'm not sure that mapping function ought to be the central function of how we teach worship in the local congregation, right? A worshiper needs to be equipped to enter into worship more deeply than they need a map of the field of worship studies. Yeah. And I think there is a little bit of tension there. Even, and you feel it in publishing, where you read books about worship and you say about, I mean, I look at the stack of books I have about worship, it's a rather large stack, and I think, now how many of these books are written for seminary students, pastors, and people in the field, versus how many are written for members of the congregation, right? And it's probably like 20 to 1. Yeah. And I think one of the big differences is most of those books map things, as opposed to maybe the pilgrimage or eating kind of metaphor. And then maybe the second metaphor is this idea of sequential building. All right? And here's why it concerns me. If I, as a non-chemistry student, want to learn about chemistry, I start with Chemistry 101, and then I go to Chemistry 102. But when we begin to, and I enter Chemistry 101, in fact, 99% of the people who go to Chemistry 101 know almost nothing about chemistry, right? My faculty colleagues who teach those courses can start from scratch. But isn't this very different when it comes to worship? Is that everybody comes with some prior formation, experience, some prior, even if it's a negative experience, right? Even if it's a set of cultural experiences. They've never been in church in their life, but they have, from the culture at large, experienced all kinds of musical sounds and artistic sounds that will either help them connect with or be frustrated by the way the church uses those art forms. In other words, teaching worship never starts from scratch. Right? We always work with the materials that are given in people's prior experiences. But now I want to say, I think that's actually a freeing thing. Because if we had the sense that, wow, we get to start teaching worship from scratch and build this complete building of knowledge, I actually think that would be a responsibility that none of us could finally bear. We would be crushed by it. That rather, teaching of worship has built in it a little aspect of provisionality. Here's a reason I love using that pilgrim metaphor when I teach, let's say, a course in worship history. When I'm using that metaphor, I do not say to students, I am the master architect of this class. We together are going to build this knowledge. And at the end, this is exactly the building we're going to build based on my architectural imprint. Instead, I can say to them, we are like fellow pilgrims. And yeah, I'm the tour guide. I've taken this tour of church history a few times. But you know, every tour guide who's on a tour sees things for the first time, experiences them in new ways. And we as teachers become part of the learning culture. And there's less the power and the pitfalls with having to determine everything according to a pre-mapped blueprint. Anyway, I think there's a whole field of study here, and I didn't want to take more than a few minutes, but it is a fascinating, I think, and helpful way in. Now, turn ahead about two pages in this handout to page 5. And this page 5 includes just some open questions. We'll not get to all of these today, but I would like to have us talk about a couple. And I'd like to actually get the interaction going in the room just a little bit. And so I'd like to toss out, as just a way of gathering up some of the things we talked about yesterday and continuing to set the stage for today, naming some dangers in the teaching of worship. See it on the bottom of page 5, number 4? What are some big dangers in the teaching of worship? I've just named one. That we will think of ourselves as chief architects of perfectly pristine buildings, which will be developed according to our blueprint, without regard for the experience and learning that we will engage in as we learn. So I'm still in session 1, page 5, right? At the bottom of the page. Okay. What are some dangers in teaching worship? Oh, that we will overly spiritualize it. That we will only focus on matters of form and style. That we will overly intellectualize it. That we will suggest we have the only right way to worship. I would welcome some additional help on this list. Will you, in groups of 2 or 3, try to name what you believe, and maybe there are riffs on this, or other dynamics or dimensions, or other big dangers when it comes to teaching worship? All right. How many can we add to this working list? Help us out here. Do not be bad. Go here next, Brad.
First thing I thought of was the exact opposite of your first point here, that we reduce worship to a formula to take all the mystery and awe out of worship.
Ah, take mystery and awe out of worship. Big danger. Absolutely. Thank you. Good. Yep. Tracy.
One of the things that I was really aware of is that when we start teaching people about worship, we have the danger of causing them to become self-conscious about the worship that they do, to the extent where they know we stifle the very thing we're trying to grow.
Ah, to become self-conscious, we stifle the very thing we're trying to grow. Very good. Yeah, Judy? Inadvertently produce worship snaps. That's right. There's a new, actually, I can picture it, the new poster for IWS. All right? We try hard not to produce worship snaps. I can see that ad, Christianity Today, going right out. That's all right. Okay. Great. Good. Yep, go ahead.
We thought that one of the dangers is being focusing on the doing and not the being.
Ah.
And so it's kind of like
pragmatism, you just check out the list that you've done all these things.
Yeah. Focus on the doing and not the being. And then, obviously, the converse would be just focusing on the being and not the doing. And there's this beautiful right in the middle, right, where we engage in the doing in such a way that it becomes part of the being, right? Those things connect. And incidentally, that's why I love the diet metaphor for music, right? You become what you sing. So you're engaged in the singing, but we become so grateful about it, the way it becomes part of us. Yeah. So that holds those things together. Thank you very much. Excellent. Anyone else want to add to the list?
Individualize.
Say just a bit more about it.
Well, the danger in worship is you teach it, the person's, this is what I want out of worship, or this is the way I want it.
Right.
Worship is a communal activity.
Right. Yeah, it can be a big challenge, especially, I think, in a local, picturing 10 people in a small group conversation, of choosing to have the discipline when they're talking about worship to only use first-person plural words for a half hour. Can you make it 30 minutes without reverting to I and me and mine and just use we? That would be a really good discipline in that teaching setting. Great. A couple more? Go ahead, Ken.
I'm just aware of the teaching, turning the sanctuary into the classroom.
Yeah, great. Yep, it's interesting, classroom has already built into it a certain kind of privileging of cognitive knowledge, right? And if we keep our understanding of growth in terms of growing in every way, perception of mystery, emotion, and yes, knowledge and narrative, all those things, it seems to me we get some freedom to talk about the growing that we do in worship. But not to have it constrained by that fairly Western idea of learning concepts, which we're doing right here, right? And is important. But take the next question on this guide, and we're going to turn to the session 5 handout in just a minute. Do not fear. We'll cover the material easily, things that we want to get to. But I just take a minute while we're having this kind of metaphorish moment and morning to think about number 6. So I'm going to just read this list of synonyms. And what I'd like to ask you as a whole group in just a minute is, which one of these really pops out at you as being a really helpful synonym for the kind of, especially the informal kind of teaching that needs to happen in congregations? Okay. Don't you love that little built-in thesaurus inside of your computer? You know, your word, just pop that thing up. This is what this is, right? This is the exercise and the built-in thesaurus. All right, so you see where I'm at, number 5 on page 6, right? So, informal teaching of worship. Do we want to impress, imprint, impart, illumine, instruct, nourish, guide, tutor, school, train, coach, highlight, stress, emphasize, disclose, convey, communicate, tell? Any energy that you have around one of those terms?
Illumine.
All right, can you put a sentence why? Illumine.
Because that could be different things for different people.
Okay.
Whereas some of these other words, it's like, do it my way.
Yeah, okay, so the other ones feel a little coercive or directive.
They do.
Right?
And it implies that it exists outside of your knowledge of it.
Okay.
If you illuminate something,
there's still a mystery.
It is there whether you know it or not.
Oh, right, so to illumine the glory and majesty of God,
yes.
Right? We are pointing away from ourselves.
Right.
Oh, I like that very much, yeah.
Should of worship, they can get defensive. And so I think the word that jumps out to me is coach.
Coach.
Encouraging them that you're right alongside them and you're not doing this because you know everything and they're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
But let's figure this out together.
I've also found in North America, at least, the word coach connects with parents. Mm-hmm. right? Kids have soccer coaches, right? And to be, for if you tell parents, it's your job to be your kid's worship coach, I found that communicates. There's just, you don't have to like add a three-paragraph explanation of what that is. And they kind of get the idea that, yeah, there's something more here. Just like, they parents do not want to sign their kids up for ASO soccer, pay $50, and have the kids, or have the coach show up and just run practice like total chaos. You know, the parents want kids to actually run, parents want the coaches to run drills for the kids so they learn the game, right? And there is something in that little cultural moment, music and sports, and we need every help we can get of saying, actually, do you know at church, we can do the very same thing? And just like in soccer and in music lessons, that little bit of intentionality can make this into something so much richer and deeper. So there's a cultural resonance there. Okay. Anyone else? One of these words pop out.
I'm trying to think of one of these words that fit this, and I can't come up with my own word, but to model or to witness in a transparent way so that people are drawn to Christ through watching your own life.
I like it. Good.
Illustrate.
Illustrate, model, mentor, maybe we could add. We'll have to add. But I like that very much.
What words to add?
Sure.
Discover.
Discover.
Facilitate.
Facilitate. Okay.
Inspire.
Inspire. That's got a little breath in it. All right. Inspiration. All right. That's good.
I like disclose.
Yeah.
Kind
yeah.
of the early church idea of you're entering into the mysteries. The
yes.
The whole kind of pieces that happen after you experience
absolutely.
The mystery.
Yeah, by disclose, you could write Ambrose. Ambrose, mystagogical catechesis, right, was the post-experiential teaching he did about baptism, the Lord's Supper, Cyril of Jerusalem was another one, right? Disclose.
And that's why I'd like to think about the experience that they, to experience, to invite, to immerse. It's that ritual. The ritual itself teaches.
Yes. Immersion, isn't that a nice metaphor? Oh, yeah. That one works. We want an immersion experience, right? It's really a baptismal language, right? Comes through. Okay. And then go down to number 7. I just want to harvest from yesterday. This is just a partial list, but I think we came up with some others. What are some signature teaching skills that really we need to work on, that we've talked about? All right, so working from the bottom up, finding and recommending good children's books. I hope everyone is passionate about doing that. And if you do go, by the way, to the Calvin Institute of Christian Worship website and type in children's books in a search engine, you'll get a little article by my colleague Kristen Verhalst where we have a little photograph of the cover of every children's book on worship we could find. So you'll see about 20 of them there, and we'd welcome you helping us to find more. All right? And even better, write some. Okay? Then moving up from that, you need the Dear Parents letter. Right? You can't just put the children's book in a church library and hope that it's going to be enough. You actually have to say, parents, this is something that you really need to do in your home to prompt that activity. Right? And I'm telling you, right? I drop my kids off at basketball practice, and if the basketball coach says, you got to work on these dribbling skills at home, I'm not going to be perfect, but I'm going to at least try. I kind of want to be a good basketball dad to my kids, right? Right? But I need to be prompted to do that. There's a beautiful little book Faith Alive published with the title Homegrown. And it is a book entirely written for parents. And I'm thinking of one Christian education director in a congregation who said, I used to think of my job as setting up programs for kids. But what I now realize, the most effective way I can think about my job in a congregation is equipping parents for their role in faith formation. And the church's education work ends up looking quite different if with that approach. Rewriting job descriptions. We talked about it yesterday, right? Taking the director of music position and making sure it's only 80% about what actually happens in the service and 20% about equipping. One church musician did it every year by providing to the congregation a beautiful little CD for people to put in their car stereos. Now we do it, of course, downloaded MP3 files, right? But a church musician who thinks, you know, if I can put this MP3 on a Facebook and recommend it out and have people listen to this song 2 or 3 times, it will much more likely be something they can enter into more deeply in worship. Right? The point is, the musician and the artist and the pastor and everyone involved in worship ministry needs to think of the equipping for worship as 20% of their work. Not 90% of their work, but at least 20% of their work. Yesterday we talked about the pamphlet for new members. We're going to talk a little bit later today about the power of learning how to write brief devotionals for people to use in home. And then, with great gratitude for Robert Weber, crafting sticky but not cheesy epigrams that really communicate it, right? Worship is a verb is still a great poster for the choir room at church, right? Beautiful. And then the non-didactic, thanks Ken here for your point, the non-didactic but simple two-sentence in our office, we refer to these as the in-between words, right? The things to speak in worship that are evocative, disclosive, but not too teachy, right? And I gave the example yesterday of my pastor who said, today when we pass the peace, remember that we are practicing something that we need to use all week long as we encounter people. I think he did it in two sentences. Right? Any other skills that you want to add? The informal teaching, the place that the real teaching of worship happens. Right? Other skills that came out from either yesterday or that you think of?
The use of art, the visual art, other senses.
Thank you. Absolutely. Absolutely. Put next to that the marketing posters we do. Right? Come to the Christmas Eve service, right? What does that poster look like? What does it say? What are the visual images we put with it? And the words that we use to describe what's happening, right? That's another skill, right? Other skills that come to mind. Anyone else? In the life of the church. Things that are on your resolution list already for, I want to give this a shot when I go home.
The pastoral interaction of worship leaders with the congregation before or after, perhaps that can carry over during worship service.
Okay. So, the linking of formal and liturgical leading and leading and interaction outside of the sanctuary. Those moments are huge.
John, the ongoing task of developing that musical diet that nurtures people in a changing culture.
Absolutely.
And sure, there are people as well, but you've already talked about that. But that's an ongoing skill that we never really completely arrive at.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that is a great transition, thanks, Kent, to session 5 handout.